succession number 12163, rule 3.
Mr. Fitzjohn, rule 3.
So, I vaguely remember being on the ridge with a few tanks, and apparently Colonel Foote, who later became General Foote, was in charge of these tanks. But I can remember, I'd never seen one before, a tank transporter coming and towed our tank onto it. And that was the first time we'd seen a transporter, I had anyhow, in the desert. And they took us back to the perimeter of Tobruk. And I think the place we was at was called Spanish Farm. I could be mistaken, but I'm certain. And we were about, I should think, a good 10 mile or 20 mile probably to the west of the actual town of Tobruk. And there was only our tank there. And I remember the sergeant came to the tool locker in the front of the tank to get his small kit out. And laid on his towel inside of his small pack was a ominous red object, which was a 75 millimeter German shell, which had penetrated the skirting. Matilda had a skirting over the tracks, the hull of the tank, and had come to rest in his small pack, which when we decided, after the wonder of it all, it was approximately a foot from my head. So, between my head as I was driving, on the right-hand side was the two 12-volt batteries at the side of the tank, and then the tool locker with his packing. So this 75 millimeter shell we'd been carrying around from the Battle of the Cauldron. Anyway, that was beside the point. An officer, I don't know who he was now to this day, came and told us that the regiment was being relieved and sent back to Palestine, and that another regiment was coming up to relieve us, and we had to stop with our tank and we'd be picked up. Note the words, picked up. And away he went. And we were approximately 2 or 3, minimum I think, of 3 days with our tank. Nobody else there, just the four of us and a broken down tank. And we had plenty of rations, we weren't starving. And one day a South African armoured car appeared, much to our relief. But as it got nearer, the turret moved ominously towards us, and it was manned by Germans.
Did it have German insignia on?
No, not then. No, it must have happened all so quick, they'd just got everything. We didn't know this armoured car. I'll come to it in a minute, and it came across, and we realised then we were prisoners of war, and that was it. And couldn't believe it. There were in no way, there was no putting our hands up and all that. It was just more or less like friends talking away. I'll give them the due. And there was a young lad, well, I was only young myself, but he was young to me, he looked about 18. And in quite good English, he apologised that we weren't his prisoners. He says, "You're prisoners of the Italians," all troops captured in Libya, where he says, "You're not prisoners of the Germans, you're prisoners of the Italians," and he apologised, which to me, I couldn't understand why. But anyway, they sort of motioned us along, and I vaguely remember marching along for a few miles, and nobody taking much notice. You know, the armoured car wasn't bothering us anyway, whatever. And we came suddenly in sight of a sight I'll never forget. I thought it was the entire British Army marching along in captivity. And it was the Tobruk garrison. And Tobruk had fallen. And we were unaware of it. We were on the western side of it, patiently waiting to be picked up. And in the meantime, we'd heard nothing or no clue whatever that Tobruk had fallen. And so we just joined up with all the rest of them as prisoners of war. And from there we went to Derna, the next town up from Tobruk. And we were in a... They said it was a disused Arab cemetery we were in. It was barbed wired round and there was... I can't tell you, hundreds and hundreds of us in this barbed wire encampment. And more or less, could I say, a comic opera Italian officer came all dolled up with his fancy boots gleaming away and he started trying to take pictures of us all. Well, the reaction was immediately he put his camera up, everybody gave the V for victory sign. And after a few attempts to take a picture, he lost his temper and pulled out a revolver and threatened them, all of them. Once again, all our fingers went up. So he just let off three shots into the midst of us. One lad was wounded in the arm and the other two didn't hit anything. I don't know whether he'd been firing over our heads and whether it was an accident or whether he had deliberately aimed at us. But that was my introduction to the Italian army. And, of course, we were then in charge, we were prisoners of the Italians, no longer the Germans. And there was one occasion, where there was an Italian soldier trying to sell a bottle of water to one of our prisoners for an Egyptian pound over the wire. And a German came and took it off him. Off the Italian, the water bottle, and just threw it over the wire to the English prisoner. Now, I do know that's true. And anyway, we finished off. We were taken to Benghazi. Well, thousands will be able to repeat this story now. In Benghazi, I should think there was thousands of us all in a piece of desert just wired off. There was no tents, no huts. There was just the desert and wire and sentries around. And the latrines, we just simply dug a pit round the outside, and as the weeks and months passed on, the pit was filled in and got nearer and nearer till I think we were nearly living in a latrine. We were living on English biscuits, and we didn't even get English bully. We got some round tins of it was more like, I assume, goat meat or something in water. It said AMMS on them. It was, I assume, Italian bully beef or the equivalent thereof. And of course there was no hot water, no fires, no, not even any ersatz coffee. You lived on this and water. And after a few weeks they started taking so many hundred or a shipload at a time across to Italy as they had a ship available in Benghazi, going back empty to Italy, taking so many prisoners. Well, this Jimmy Campbell, he lives in Airdrie, actually, Scotland, and I know he's still alive. We decided that whatever happened, we'd hang on as long as we could, because there'd be... Well, we'd never heard of El Alamein, but we knew that there'd be... It'd be our turn to come back up the desert. It got to the up and down. And we thought if we could hang on to the last minute, we might either escape and meet them or get released. Of course, people say, why didn't you try to escape from there? Well, with about what? I don't know. I should think 500 miles of desert to cross. You'd been starving and for weeks, well, months. You'd no food. I mean, what could you do? But we hung on and hung on, and I think, by what I can gather, we must have been on the high seas as El Alamein had already started. But we didn't sail, the last few of us didn't sail from Benghazi. They took us to Tripoli, to another camp, which must have been a hellhole. It was worse than Benghazi. And the name's, I'll never forget, it's Suwanee Ben Adam. S-U-A-N-N-I, Suwanee Ben Adam. And there they had a mobile shower, and we had the first shower, well, the first shower or bath I'd had since Alexandria days. That was October 1941.
Did you have
the lice? We did, yes, I've come into that. And then I can remember having this mobile shower, and as we stepped out of the showers, there was mobile, onto the sand. This, I'm exaggerating now, but you had a pair of black socks on, and when you looked, moving up your legs, was a horde of sand fleas. There must have been millions of these sand fleas all over this camp in Suwanee Ben Adam. And then, of course, the lice, well, it became common, and even more common when we were prisoners in Italy. You'd be in a camp in Italy and there'd be the Italian sentries with the shirts off, cracking lice. They were the sentries, so you can imagine what we were like. I've always attempted to play the game and say, well, the Italians had nothing. You couldn't, you know, we couldn't expect anything from them. But I'm sorry that I can't. I've detested them ever since. And I've never dreamed of going back to Italy for a holiday, or I have nothing whatever to do with them. And we were taken across to
Sicily. What was the attitude of the Italians towards you?
You'd come across one who'd be not too bad, but he was always some motive for it. He was always wanting to exchange you something. Do you follow what I mean? But what can I say? You put a beggar on horseback and he'll ride to the devil, which reminds me of those. There were always the down and outs, and suddenly they find themselves the victors over British. You know, they were like all heroes to themselves, strutting around, which we found horrible. And we landed at Capua, which is in Italy, at a transit camp. And I'll always remember, we got a Red Cross parcel. This is the first Red Cross parcel we'd seen. And it was to share between five of us. You know, this was in the transit camp. We assumed it was temporarily. So we got this parcel. And I can vividly remember cutting a tin of meat roll-up into five equal portions. There was a Peak Freen's apple pudding, which was cut in a tin, and we cut everything into five equal portions, which didn't come to an average meal nowadays. But we were absolutely full, because the simple reason, over the months of captivity in Benghazi, and our stomachs had shrunk to such an extent that these little portions of food were absolutely full up. And that was one of the first impressions I got at Benghazi, at Capua. And then from there, we went to a permanent camp at a place called Porto San Giorgio, which is about, I should think, 60 miles or so south of Leghorn, on the eastern side of Italy. And there was about 7,000 in this camp. And, of course, you didn't work in Italy. You just spent the entire day delousing, or starting off with a bar of chocolate out of your Red Cross parcel, when we got them, going round the camp, bartering, swapping, until you'd finished off with a tin of bully from your bar of chocolate. But we used to spend our day just doing nothing. Absolutely, utterly boring. And then suddenly we heard the marvellous news that the war was over, and that a British convoy was... The senior British officer in charge of the camp told us that a convoy was coming to Ancona with food, medical supplies, everything for us, and we hadn't to leave the camp. Well, can you imagine trying to control about 7,000 people, prisoners in a camp? So we just ignored him. Well, the Italians had already fled. There was no sentries. We just invaded the countryside around. And the first meal I had was we absolutely stripped a farmer's fig tree of ripe figs. I don't know the disastrous results to our stomachs afterwards, but the second day, they wanted the Brigade of Guards prisoners to be armed with the Italian rifles to keep us in. I can remember that, which once again we just knew what they could do. But anyhow, was on the fourth day, we're just wandering out all over the place, getting what we could, coming back on a night to sleep. The fourth day we walked up, and of course it was ringed by German armoured cars and tanks. And the war hadn't finished. Only Italy had. Now, we was never told that. If we'd have known, we could have all scarpered, and probably 50% of us could have probably got away. So we were just waiting for them to. So from there we went to Germany. And, of course, I thought, well, this is going to be such things as Belsen, Auschwitz, things you never heard of then. But I thought, Germany, it's going to be horrible as this. And we went to a camp called Mulhausen. There was Russians there in a horrible state, I agree. But forget that. We were sent to, 60 of us were sent on a little working party.
And what was the name of the place?
Mulhausen. This was like another transit camp effort. And we went on this working party and was at a railway siding at a place called Werdau, Werdau. It's near Erfurt, Zwickau, near the Czech border, actually. And we had like a room at the back of a eating house affair made into a camp and barbed wired off, and we had a Feldwebel and so many sentries in charge of us, and we worked on the railway siding. Well, honestly, I must admit it was a pleasure to work after the months of inactivity, and all we were doing was unloading up briquettes or sand. We were never asked to do anything like war work. And in charge of us was an old chap. We nicknamed him Wingy. He had one arm, and he was just like a jovial garden gnome, this old German, and he rode a three-wheel bike, old Wingy. And he was very good to us. He was a gentleman, you know. He was okay with old Wingy. And I remember, we started, of course, pinching potatoes and all sorts, you know, whatever we could. Naturally, you live by pinching. I think there used to be four to a wagon of sand, and you had to unload it onto these big lorries. Wolbrechthausen was the name of the firm. It's always stopped in my mind. And I forget the exact circumstances, but we must have worked a bit too hard, and we got the sand unloaded, and then we got the job of unloading another one. So we had more or less a trade union meeting with Wingy, and we explained that we'd unload a wagon of coal, briquettes as they were, or sand, and then we'd finish for the day. And after a bit of umming and ahhing, he decided that was it. So I think he got a few English cigarettes or a bit of chocolate for his kids or something to quieten him down. So after that, we used to really go to town, go and work, unload the sand or the briquettes, get back to camp for lunchtime and have the rest of the day to ourselves. It was quite, you know, bearable. Well, one day, the Feldwebel came. Oh, by the way, one of our lads found a way out over the wire, and he got very friendly with German woman whose husband was on the Russian front. And he used to manage to come back in the morning. And he got caught coming in one morning. And it was a horrible punishment. Nothing happened to him. But whenever he used to get a Red Cross parcel of cigarettes after that, a load of them used to be given to the Feldwebel to keep quiet about the incident. And
where did he come from, this chap?
I couldn't tell you, but he wanted my regiment. We were all mixed up, different. And every Friday, we used to march to the centre of the village, to the public baths, and have a shower. And the first day we marched there, I don't know which one of us it was, but turned Hitler's face, there's a big picture of Hitler, turned his face to the wall. And gosh, we got no more baths for a month as punishment, which wasn't too bad. We could, but eventually, by then we were receiving Red Cross parcels. We were all out working. We were pinching, swapping and bargaining. We were living for prisoners. We had a belly full every night, put it that way. And every Friday when we went to the for our showers, everybody polished and cleaned and shaved and washed and made them smell as smart as possible. And we used to march to the showers every Friday night. And the streets used to be lined with all the villagers. It was their entertainment for the week, I think, watching us march by. And we used to really go to town and march properly. And we used to do little tricks like we'd smoke a cigarette and throw the cigarette end down and watch the German civilians grab to pick it up, or throw a square of chocolate to the kids. And we became more like liberators than prisoners. It was the entertainment of the week to watch the English march by. And another very amusing incident once, we'd got two old sentries with us who'd been on the Russian front, and I think one had been wounded. They were pretty old to us. So we decided we'd do a Highland Light Infantry pace to the shower baths. And we got about 200 yards in front of the sentries, who was puffing and panting, shouting for us to stop behind us, to the merriment of this German crowd of civilians. I always remember that. It was a daft little thing, but it gives you a good feeling. Can you imagine it?
Yes.
And they were chasing after us, trying to catch up with us, and everybody laughing like mad. I thought there was going to be trouble over that, but there wasn't. And then one morning we was all on parade, and the Feldwebel, he wanted a volunteer for another job. And you know, in the army you never volunteer for anything, do you?
No.
And I volunteered. I thought, I'm going to take a gamble. And I was sent to work for IG Farben. Do you know IG Farben?
Yes.
I'm not trying to be clever. E.G. Farben, as it was known, Bayer Medicals. And where I went, I marched with a sentry through the village, and it was, they call it the Schützen House. It had been a shooting range, the clubhouse of a pre-war shooting range, and a real nice building, and it had been more or less gutted. Shells put in, it was full of medical stuff. And I was supposed to be what they called the Schwerarbeiter, the heavy worker, to help them. You know, push a barrow with a carton of pills and that about. And I thought, wow, this is a marvellous job for a prisoner. And all the people there were elderly Germans, you know. And I never once was abused or in any way. They were all right with me. And you must speak the truth, mustn't you?
Yes.
They were all right. And we used to argue about, they used to say, remember this, Harold. They used to call me Harold. We should be fighting with you against the Russians. And don't forget, one day you'll regret it. And I used to say, oh, propaganda, no, no. And I've often thought afterwards, it makes one think, doesn't it?
Do you think they were right?
I don't know. It's debatable. I'd rather fight against no one, but That's, they always used to insist that they were, England and Germany should have been allies against the Russians. But anyway, a few amusing incidents there. I got to know, in fact, I can rattle off now Bayer medical and medicine products as though I've worked there only yesterday, you know, starting with A's, Atibrins, Aspirin, Betaxine, Citrine, and go right through. And, of course, by then I was speaking a bit of German, and I used to go sauntering along when I could, and there was one thing took me out, they called it Priovit, or Priovit in English, and they were an orange-coloured, like a Smartie, vitamin C tablets. No, that was Citrine, I'm lying, sorry. No, they were multivitamin tablets, Priovit. So I used to start chewing them, and they were like little sweets, they were smashing. Well, I used to pinch them wholesale and take them back to the camp and give them all to the lads. And we used to eat these bad, they're lovely. And eventually, we was all coming out in boils and sores and ulcers and things, and we was getting too many vitamins. It takes them to believe it. And that's the only thing we could put it down to, taking it. And then, if anybody went sick, they had to go on the train to the nearest camp, to the MO, it was a French MO, and be escorted back. I then started a service whereby I was supplying pills with a fictitious sick prisoner, going with the prisoner to the doctor and taking, you know, whatever he could, aspirins or whatever the order was. And we were in a regular service of supplying the stuff I was working with it. And then right opposite where I worked, I was as a prisoner, you're not supposed to have any contact with German civilians, only as you must in your work. But right opposite where I worked, in Verdau, there was two huge bay-winded houses had been joined together into a hospital. And on the first floor landing, there was a girl or a young woman laid on a bed convalescing, and she used to wave every time she saw me, and I used to wave back. I used to think, I don't know where it is. And one day I had some boxes of tablets and things, loading them onto a lorry, and a girl walked by, and, well, she was more of a woman than a girl, but as I found out later, she walked by and she looked all round, and there was only me there, and I think the old chap I worked with, who was pretty harmless. And she came to me and she put a little sandwich in my hand. And each day she used to walk by and give me an apple or a sandwich or something. And the old chap German who was in charge of me says, "You'll be getting into trouble, Harold." He said, "That's a kinder hospital, you know, kidnapping children." And I got to know they called her Krista, and she'd be 15 then. And every day she passed by and brought me something. Well,